If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Supernatural Circumstances, the podcast where we take you down the rabbit hole into the fantastic world of the strange, the paranormal, and the unknown. I'm Morgan Knutson.
And I am Mike Brown. It's time to dim the lights and settle in. Come on along with us on this week's adventure. And this one is one that I have been interested in for a very long time. Really long time. Is this real? What's going on with this kind of stuff? This week, we're going to be talking about exorcisms.
Yeah, and I am so thrilled that I think we've probably got one of the best guests that we could have this episode in Matt Baglio, the author of The Rite, of Argo, and the incredible documentary Hostage to the Devil, which has garnered a lot of attention because, I mean, this subject matter, it is so taboo to talk about. Getting information on it can be really, really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes a journalist like Matt to really get to the bottom of a lot of this.
Yeah, I mean, what we hear about exorcism usually is all from movies. I mean, we know The Exorcist, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and movies like The Rite, for example. But I think The Rite stands out in a different way in that it's based on Matt's experiences digging into this topic at the Vatican itself, where he took a course, which is really, really fascinating.
So fascinating. And for anybody out there who has not seen The Rite, it stars Anthony Hopkins, and it is a phenomenal film. Sir Anthony is top of his game as usual. And the story in real life centers around a father by the name of Father Gary Thomas, this incredible individual who really went in as a skeptic. He went into all this going, I don't know if I believe in this. I don't know what's, you know, he was completely skeptical, which is very rare, I think.
That's the healthiest way to look at it, too. Personally, I don't believe in demons. Yeah. I just don't believe in them. I have a personal bias in that regard. However, after learning a bit more and reading Matt's book and all of that kind of thing, I do see that there is a place in the world for things like exorcism, and that they do have value.
Yeah, and that's my position too. I mean, I'm a pretty spiritual person, I think, as most people know, and to me, a lot of these negative entities and things like that are truly a projection or a thought form. And so I agree. Like, I'm not a religious person. You know, like you, I mean, we've talked about this so much. Like, I'm far more of that spiritual side. And I think there's a purging of that negative emotion that comes with exorcism that is valuable. There's something in there that's valuable, no matter what culture we're talking about.
Right.
And that's what's interesting to me about this.
Because the people, perhaps, who are undergoing an exorcism actually believe in the things that are happening, if that makes any sense. It just seems to work for them for some reason. So it's really fascinating.
Totally, totally. And I mean, now we've, thank God, we've got Matt to explain some of this stuff and break it down. So I say we get talking to him.
Yeah, let's do it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Matt, first of all, thank you so much for joining us today. I've read your work and followed your work, and it's just such an honor to have you. So thank you so much for coming on tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
The wonderful book that you wrote, The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist, is just so utterly fascinating. And for the audience listening, I just want to say, if you have not read this, this is hands down a must-have on your shelf for anybody who's fascinated in this subject. So growing up for you, Matt, what was your view on things like consciousness and the paranormal stuff? Did you have any spiritual beliefs or preconceptions going into any of this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I was always curious as a kid growing up, and I think that's kind of precursor to why I became a writer. I'm fascinated about different things. I want to know how things work when I hear great stories. And I'm also curious about, you know, things that I don't know anything about. And I have a very open mind. So topics about UFOs and spirits and all these kinds of things, I love to read about them and you know, hear about people's opinions and things like that. When it came to exorcism, I didn't really know anything about it. And I was raised Catholic, so I was familiar with, you know, the ethos, the beliefs and all of that behind the church and everything. But I didn't think that exorcism was really still a thing. And it was when I was here in Rome that I heard about this course. You know, it was being taught at a modern university. It purported to train exorcists. And so I just was like, I've got to go down and figure out what this is all about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would have been right there with you. it's so fascinating. And it's so hidden. I remember I do a live show called Ritual, and I talk about various exorcism cases. And I was blown away. The one show that I did, there was actually two priests that were in the audience, and I didn't know this until they came up to me after the show and said, "We actually learned something about this today." And I was really floored by that it was not something even amongst them that was highly talked about.
Yeah, that is true, and it's very fascinating. It was one of the first things that I learned, and I found incredibly fascinating, is that a lot of priests don't know anything about it. And that was kind of one of the reasons behind why this group wanted to teach this course. They wanted to introduce priests and the modern church, if you will, to kind of what the church teaches about exorcism, because it's a very specific thing. And, you know, exorcism is a topic that goes into every religion. It isn't just the Catholic approach. You know, there's the evangelicals, and pretty much any denomination, any religion out there has a form of exorcism. So it was interesting to me, you know, when you get down to it and you find out what the church really teaches about all these things, and then to hear Catholic priests say, you know, well, I didn't know that, or I didn't believe it. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember when I was researching my one show, and it was really intriguing to me how even way back to like the Assyrian tablets, you had these descriptions of illnesses or ailments that like epilepsy or things like that, that people had attributed to these things. But even then, it was, there were forms of exorcism and whatnot that were kind of coming out so early on. But you went into this, like you were saying, like with an open mind and whatnot, and you ended up meeting Father Gary Thomas. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
So when I got to the course, I had no idea what to expect. And I went there to learn about what they were teaching. but also was curious about the students. And one of the students I met was Father Gary Thomas, who is a real priest. That's his name. He's a priest in the diocese up near San Jose in California. And he was very open and honest about his experiences. He said, I'm here. My bishop told me to come here to learn to become an exorcist. I didn't know anything about it, to touch on what, you know, what we were just talking about. And, you know, he sort of started to relate his experiences. And this was early on for him. He hadn't yet met an exorcist that he could apprentice to, because the course was just, you know, like a practical, I guess you could say it was a, it was just, you know, behind the scenes kind of giving you the basis. He needed the practical training that he couldn't get. So he had to find an actual exorcist. And this goes to the secretive nature of it. I mean, there weren't a lot of exorcists out there who wanted to talk to outsiders, who wanted to train, you know, Catholic priests. And even if they were Catholic priests, but because they were coming from America. So these were Italians. This happened in Rome. He didn't speak Italian. So that was another aspect of his story that was interesting. So when I met him, you know, he's just really talkative guy, very open about his experiences, told me he was looking for an exorcist. And then I think it was 2 weeks later, he came back to me and he said, hey, Matt, I found an exorcist. I'm apprenticing to him. And you're not going to believe what I'm seeing. And he and I just went and had a coffee, and he started to tell me about everything that was going on in his life, all his emotions, his feelings. And he had all these questions that he didn't... What I found really refreshing about him, he was very upfront about, I'm seeing this. I don't know what that is. That doesn't make any sense. And the world he started to describe to me was so different than anything I had read about or heard about, or definitely seen in Hollywood, in a Hollywood movie, that I was immediately hooked. And I said, wow, this is, he would be a great subject for a book.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So yeah, you mentioned just now about that even his perception was changed as he was going through this course. What was it for him that was unexpected? Was it the teachings themselves, or was it the things that he was seeing and being introduced to? Like, what was going through his head?
You know, I guess the short answer is it was a little bit of both. I don't think he was surprised about the teachings of the church about who the devil is, who the church says the devil is.
Sure.
And the reality of demonic possession and those kind of things. He wasn't against it, but he wasn't here because he was an ardent believer and he was going to prove his beliefs and those kind of things. So he was very open-minded.
Yeah.
You could say he was kind of a casual skeptic, but in Silicon Valley, that was his parish. So, you know, he's in the most modern area of America, kind of dealing with,
geez,
with technology and stuff like that. So I think for him and for me, one of the most surprising things was, one, how frequent it is here in Rome. It's very common. There's a lot of exorcists. They're seeing people all the time. You know, this is true back when I wrote the book, yeah. And that it was, I think, was the reactions he was seeing. Most of us, we associate exorcism with what we see in the movies. So we see these extreme cases, Annalise Michel, or, you know, the movie The Exorcist, or Malachi Martin, you know, some of Hostage to the Devil, some of those cases that are really extreme. But some of these cases were just bizarre. I mean, people, there was a waiting room. He went to see the exorcist. When he finally got a chance to apprentice to this exorcist, he was a Capuchin. So his monastery was connected to the cemetery because the Capuchins are responsible for maintaining the cemeteries. So he's basically in a mausoleum and he's going to see his first exorcism, and there's a little waiting room, and he's looking at these people, just as what I did, because later on I went and I participated in some exorcisms so I could see what was really going on. And so you sit there and you're watching these people, and it's just fascinating. You're like, they're normal people. They look like, it looks like a businesswoman. It looks like a businessman. It looks like a person who is just coming in after they've been to the grocery store. They wearing tracksuits and all these kind of things. And then they go into this little room. the priest begins the ritual and everything changes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that gives me goosebumps. So you, when you got to do this as well, what did you see as that change? What happened?
Well, you know, I was trying, my goal when I wrote the book was I want this to be the most accurate book I can, you know, I can do.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to compare myself to anybody else. I'm not an exorcist.
Sure.
I'm a journalist. I'm a writer. So, but I could speak Italian. And I went in there. I had the advantage of kind of talking to Father Gary. He would give me his questions. I would talk to the priest that he was apprenticing to. I would ask those questions and kind of do a go-between. I think for me, what was your question again?
Well, just what changes did you see? Because you were describing just how mundane everybody looked, whether you're sitting in the waiting room and they're waiting for this to happen. And then there was this shift.
Right. How they changed. Yes, for sure. I mean,
yeah.
And again, this goes back to how weird it was. It was different. Everybody was different. And that's kind of one of the things that Father Gary learned. Like every reaction is different. Every person's case is different. And initially when he went there to see his first set of exorcisms, he didn't go away with this, you know, thinking, oh my God, I've seen the proof that I've come searching for. He actually didn't believe that the people he had seen undergo an exorcism really were possessed. Like they were reacting, some were yawning, some were just coughing, some were sitting absolutely still, rocking back and forth. And occasionally you'd get, you know, the moaning and the groaning and stuff like that. So he, you know, he didn't see any of these really extreme cases right away. But then eventually they began to sprinkle in because he was apprenticing for more than a couple months. And the strong cases are a person goes in, they seem normal, but they look like they're dealing with an issue. Let's put it that way. They look like they're maybe a little uncomfortable. And then they go into the room. In this case, the exorcist had a small room near his office where he would perform the ritual. And it had this faux wood paneling that kind of went up, you know, about 5 feet off the ground. And when I went in and saw the room, you could see there was a chair where the person would sit in, a metal chair. And behind that metal chair, along the wall where the top of the chair was all scraped up. Like the chair had just been rubbing back and forth against the wall. And when he started to see these stronger cases, you got into that more physical response by the person. Or you hear the voice, that guttural growling voice. He saw there are a couple of cases I document in the book where, you know, the person's eyes changed. They became really thick. Another priest, Father Vince Lampert, who I've seen him give some talks recently, but he was also there, and I document this in the book, and he saw a woman levitate. He says he saw a woman levitate. Father Gary said he didn't see that. And I think that's another interesting aspect of it. It's that the phenomena has a different experience, like depending on, it's a very personal, and it was very hard to capture that in the book because it's something that, and I think it's really hard in recordings. If you were to put a camera there and record it, and it's not the same experience you would get if you were there in person.
Sure. No, and that makes sense. Like, I mean, when you think about walking into a space with that, having a certain, what they would call a vibe or anything like that. I mean, it's really hard to translate any of that into writing or, like you say, on camera or anything like that.
Right. And I think in the cases, the most extreme cases, the ones that I documented in the book, were actually stories that were told to me by these exorcists. I was able to interview, I think, a dozen, maybe more exorcists. A lot of them were Italians. And they would tell me these stories that were incredible. And I found what was interesting about interviewing these exorcists was that each one was different. You know, each exorcist, I mean, was different. The way that they approached the ritual. Now, the ritual is very specific. You know, you have to speak it and pray it in a certain way, let's say. But each exorcist kind of does their own thing. And you know, within the guidelines of the ritual. And some exorcists are actually really, really sophisticated. They speak multiple languages. They have PhDs. So that was interesting to me, too. They had different experiences. One exorcist would pray the ritual in a foreign language, in French, I think he told me. He would get reactions from the demon or from the person who was possessed in a language that was, you know, Italian. So the person would reply in Italian, or sometimes they would reply in French, and you would, you know, those kind of things were interesting. And those were the stories, I think, for me, that were the most fascinating, because obviously the personal element of Father Gary and what he was going through was really incredible. But then sprinkled around it, you had all these exorcists who were telling their, you know, the most extreme cases of the things that they'd seen that had really shocked them. And Father Gary didn't really see any of those cases. He did see one case that was really incredible for him. It was very spiritual for him to see it. You know, like I described, the woman's eyes changed. He said they were thick like a Coke bottle. The exorcism went on for like 2 hours. Normally, they were really short.
Wow.
Normally, the exorcisms were only like 30 minutes. So he didn't have that full, you know, apparitional, people vomiting up objects that were disappearing and all those kind of things. But enough exorcists did that had me thinking, you know, wow, there's something more going on here than I think really people are understanding.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like I remember reading the first time I read Hostage to the Devil, and the cases in there were things that I had never heard about before. I mean, I've been in parapsychology for 20 plus years, and there were things that were described throughout, you know, throughout that book and throughout yours where, yeah, it really begins to shift your understanding, I think, of reality and what everybody's experience is. I know it did for me, and it was definitely two books for me that were just really, really, really unforgettable. Was there a point in a specific interview or any, like a tipping point of sorts for you when you thought, okay, like something is seriously going on here, and you were kind of leaning maybe a little bit more to the belief side, or did you stay in that sort of removed journalistic position?
I tried to stay as much as I could into the removed journalistic position. I obviously was very empathetic to Father Gary and his feelings and the things he was seeing. And I tried to write the book primarily through his eyes, because I thought it was important for the reader to understand his experiences rather than my own. Like I said, I was able to sort of insert myself in certain places because I talked to the exorcist that he apprenticed to. And then I talked to everybody at the course. So the course was, you know, being taught by psychiatrists. They brought in other exorcists, and I was able to interview them and talk to them enough to get a good sense. I think for me, you know, there was, and I'm very open-minded, like I was talking about earlier, and I wasn't coming at this from a standpoint of I have a purpose. I just wanted to write the most accurate and, you know, portrayal I could of this topic in a non-sensational way, and let the material kind of speak for itself, because the material itself is sensational, right? You have a woman who's, and I go through many interviews where I've talked to people and they're telling me what the experience is like when the demon is possessing them. And I had this one woman, I was sitting with an exorcist in the room where he performs the ritual, and he was telling me, okay, this next woman who comes in, she could go into the trance while we're talking. So let's, you know, just, if you see it happen, just stand there and, you know, don't do anything. I'll take care of it. And in walks this woman. She couldn't have been, I don't know, 25. And she looked very sweet, very kind. She had a Puma tracksuit on. She was there with her mom, and I think it was her older brother, or it could have been a cousin, somebody like that. And they were sitting in these chairs. She was very nervous. I had a recorder going. I was recording her voice. The exorcist was behind his desk with his helper. And I'm asking her questions. And so I ask her this question. I say, well, what's it like when you feel the demon begin to affect you? And she started to go into a trance. First she started to answer the question. And then she kind of closed her eyes. And well, first it was like she was blinking, and then it was she was blinking a little bit too long, and then her eyes kind of, you could just see them sort of going back and forth rapidly behind her eyelids. And she was smiling afterwards and saying, oh no, I can't, you know, like she had lost her breath. And the exorcist was immediately on his feet. He's like, okay, okay, okay. And I kind of knew already from my research that that was a sign that I should maybe be ready. And then I walked out of the room. That was, the interview was over, and I walked out of the room, and you could still hear, because I was in a church in the middle of the room. And then he begins the exorcism. You could just hear her howling and screaming. And for me, the aspect of exorcism, which is interesting, is that, and this is something that Father Gary touched on, there's a human suffering element to it, where I think most people, they see the movies and they think, okay, the demon is in this person. The person is walking around like a homicidal maniac. They're going to climb up the wall. They're going to jump at me. It's not like that. It's a much more, you're in front of somebody who's suffering. You can see their suffering. Now, me, I don't know if that's a demonic possession. I can't say that that woman's reaction was because an actual demon was in her or not. But I know that she was suffering. I know her family was suffering. When she was telling me the story of what it was like for her to under, you know, the depression, the isolation, all the tragedies she was feeling in her life, I could see the tears in her mother's eyes. I could see the frustration in her and her cousin. I knew it was a part of this woman's life. And so when you're in front of that, you want that person to get better. And I think that's kind of one of the things that I took away from this whole experience, and what I think Father Gary did as well. These people are very, you know, going through an immense amount of suffering. You want to help them. And so the fear element kind of goes out of it.
Yeah, I so get that. I know even in, not that I've seen anything even close to that, but just in various cases that I've investigated over the years is that really is what it comes back to. You know, even in cases of, you know, haunting, whether it's real or not real, for the people, it's the upset is very real. The human element is very real. And like, I've always said that, you know, as much as people want to make it about the phenomenon, it really does come back to the people themselves. And like you touched on something too, Matt, that I thought was really, really interesting, which is the involvement of psychologists and psychiatrists and things like that in these cases. Let's talk about that a bit, because I think that's where most people's heads go with this subject, is that, you know, this is mistreated mental illness. What did you learn about that?
You know, it's a great question. I think for me, one of the interesting aspects of the course was that they were going to have a psychiatrist actually come in and talk about the differences between mental illness as he saw them and what the signs are for demonic possession. Now, every religion has a different approach. The Catholic Church, if you want to get into the specifics of the ritual itself, like an exorcism ritual is a very specific thing. It can be divided up into two different kinds of prayers. One, it's more, one is called a lesser exorcism, where you're basically doing a blessing. You're just kind of saying, oh, let's hope that God will come down and help this person. That's not really, quote unquote, an exorcism. Technically it is, but it isn't. The exorcism that we associate with the movies and things is a major exorcism, and that is when they use the imperative, you know, and I command you. They're using the name of Jesus. They're commanding the evil spirit. And that's a very suggestive prayer. It's not, and I looked at the sociocognitive approach to mental disorders and all the kinds of ways in which a person's goal-oriented behavior can be very influenced through interviews, through a prayer. I mean, if I'm a priest and I have this authority about my position, and you're coming to see me because your life isn't going well, and you think it's somebody told you, oh, you've been cursed, or you have a evil spirit that, you know, is possessing you, and you come to see me, and I start leading you down that path by doing an interview with leading questions and such, and then I'm going to say this prayer, and I use the words of the ritual, which are, cast you out, foul serpent, and all these kind of things. Well, it's no surprise that you may act like a serpent, or you may start acting these things out. So that's why the Catholic Church requires that the exorcist works with trained mental health professionals. Now, do they do this 100% of the time? I hope they do. I can't say whether they do or not. I know Father Geary wanted to do that. And I know the exorcist that I interviewed, the more serious exorcist, they tended also to do the same thing. So the first thing they do when they see somebody, and this is what they call their process of discernment. I think a lot of people, you know, they assume the exorcist thinks of themselves as some sort of holy man. And I think one of the great things about the exorcist, his name is Father Carmine, who Father Geary apprenticed to in Rome. He wasn't like that at all. He was a man of the earth. Like, he's like, I don't have any powers. I just interview people. I feel things. I pray. And I try to figure out what's going on with them. And then they work with mental health professionals. So the first thing they should do, they do an interview. And then they send the person to see a mental health professional. If the person is already seeing a mental health professional, which is sometimes the case, then they ask about, you know, that situation. But they usually will send them to one that they know, because they want to vet, you know, that I don't know which doctor you go and see, so I'm going to send you to the one I know. So there's all sorts of, and this is where we get into the gray area. There's all sorts of signs and things that the church says, okay, these are signs of demonic possession, like abnormal strength, talking in a language that you, or understanding a language that you don't know, a foreign language, and then the knowledge of hidden things. So if you can know that things are there, but those things don't necessarily come from being possessed by a demon. And so the church is very cautious. They want you to see a psychiatrist. They want you to go through that process. And I did appreciate that when I was following this course and this journey that this Catholic priest was going through, that they were talking about things like, you got to be careful, because you could, if somebody's taking medication, you could say something that gets them to stop taking their medication. So you have to work through the mental health community. And I'm always suspicious when I see videos of exorcists or holy people who, you know, claim to be speaking for God, who are your problem. Immediately they just go right to it. You know, your problem is because of you're possessed by a demon. That usually is the last resort. And then talking to these exorcists, that's what they'll tell you. 95% maybe of the people who come to see them are not possessed by a demon. They have no problems with the demonic. A lot of them are influenced by pop culture, but and other reasons. But it's those people who come who say, I don't think my problem is demonic, or I don't know why I'm here. I've been to, and then they start listing all the specialists they've been to. I've been to this guy, I've been to that person, I've been to that doctor, I've been to her, I've been to everywhere I can go, every clinic I can go to, and I have all these issues. I don't know what's wrong with me. And that's when they start to suspect, okay, well, this could be a more legitimate style case. Usually the ones they weed out immediately are the people who come to them and say, okay, I have a demonic spirit attached to me and I need to get rid of it. Right away they know, like, okay, this person doesn't need help, or doesn't need my help. He needs to go somewhere else.
Yeah, that makes sense. I remember reading a number of years back, there's a book called Glimpses of the Devil, and it was by Morgan Scott Peck, and it was I always thought it was so interesting to read, because he was the psychiatrist that was the mental health professional for Malachi Martin back in the day, and his book was really, really intriguing, because he was, again, one of those people that I think was really expecting it more clear cut, okay, this is mental illness, hands down, no question. And then when he started to interview these people, he realized there was something else that wasn't right, like something that he couldn't explain. And I always found that very, really, really fascinating. And yeah, it was just a book that kind of stuck out to me. But I know after, when I was reading about Father Geary Thomas, what I thought was really interesting was just how profoundly he was shifted in the way that he viewed the spiritual world and whatnot. And, you know, having started as a rational skeptic to this practicing exorcist, and I can't imagine exploring this subject matter, especially in the way that you guys did. What did he convey to you about how he processed all of that? Like, if I'm just imagining, you know, somebody who, you know, didn't have too much of an opinion one way or the other, and then here he is being interjected into this course, and said, you know, now you're going to do this. Did he talk about that at all, as to how he was processing this idea of possession, of the supernatural, the things that he was seeing?
Absolutely. I mean, he was an open book, 100%. And that was what was so refreshing from a journal, you know, from a writer's perspective. He was willing to share with me everything, you know, the ways he was feeling affected in a negative way, you know, the temptations and the types of attacks that he thought he was getting.
Yeah.
But like I described, so he initially went to this course, was learning the book side of it, you know, what the church says who the devil is, and how the traditional teachings, let's say, of the Catholic Church on who the devil is, what kind of powers the devil has, demons, who are they, how they interact with people, which was really fascinating, and I didn't know anything about it. And then when he got into the practical side, he was learning about, you know, the pain and the suffering, and he was as a man himself who'd gone through a lot of suffering. He had a near-death experience where he had an enlarged heart that caused him to basically have a stroke or pass out and fall off a cliff, and he nearly died. He went through the process of healing, and prayer from the community of his parish helped him out. He's a very personable guy, very social, so he's involved with the community. And I think for him it was that human side, which was the most important aspect of exorcism. He saw, okay, these people are suffering. They need help. I'm going to try to help them. And I'm going to also be a resource. So even if I'm, let me just say, the other thing that a lot of misconceptions people have, one of the misconceptions people have, is that the priest is out in the street convincing people that their problem is demonic, right? It's usually that they're being approached by people. So people are coming to the community, coming to the church, coming to them saying, I have a demonic problem. And it's the job of the exorcist to calm them down. And he was seeing that aspect of his training being helpful as well. I can be a resource. I can help calm people down. I can help alleviate suffering, even if it isn't me praying the ritual. Now, then when he saw a real strong case, which is one of the things, there was a couple he saw in the book. One was a nun from Eastern Europe who would react very violently. She would smack her head into the back of the wall and scream, and you would hear the guttural voice. But then there was this other woman who he saw, who came, like the exorcist, Father Carmine, had scheduled her on the weekend. So it was just her. He wasn't going to see a bunch of people. That was the strongest. That was the Coke bottle eyes, where he really felt like this evil spirit had touched him. And it kind of, I don't want to say shook him up a little bit, but I think it gave him pause, and it made him think about this and really assess, you know, am I a spiritual, because an exorcist has to have this spiritual armor around them. They have to believe their faith. They have to practice their faith. And it, you know, it took a little bit of a moment there for him to kind of, what would it mean if this evil spirit is there watching me, you know? And that's one of the teachings one of these exorcists say, well, these evil spirits are, you know, all around, and they watch you, and they can influence you in different ways. And he came to the conclusion, I think rightly so, well, if these evil spirits do exist, well, then so does God. And if they are watching me, then so is God, and I'm okay, because I'm going to turn toward the light, and I'm going to embrace the light, and then I'll know that I'll be fine. And so I think for him, it was an acceptance that this is real, There is something real here. There's people are really suffering. And now I'm going to figure out how I can best help them and my community.
It's just profound. Like, it's just profound with the way he reconciled that with himself. And I love how he really saw the human aspect of this. That was the one thing that in your book that I really valued and took away from it, was just the human side of it that I think, the like you were saying, the movies and stuff like that really dismiss. And so you mentioned within that statement that you just made about Gary feeling that there was some sort of attacks or something like that going on with him. What was that about?
Well, so when he began to see exorcisms and participate with the priest, and, you know, this room was really incredible. So I was describing it as before, you know, the wood paneling, and it was small. I would say it was probably, you know, 7 feet by 7 feet, maybe. But it had really had high vaulted ceilings. And then you had a chair, and then you had the exorcist standing in front of the person. And then you had Father Gary was sitting in another chair against the wall, but his knees were, I mean, it was probably even smaller than 7 feet, but his knees were close. You know, he could reach out and touch the person who was in the chair, and they're, you know, flopping around and screaming and all these kind of things. So it was a very, you know, intimate experience for him. And I think being in that room, it's hot, people are sweating. So when I went to see exorcisms myself, I did see this woman who was smacking her head and the wall. And then afterwards, the stronger cases, the exorcist would let the person recover in his office. You know, he had a couch in there. And then so the waiting room was outside, with probably 10 people in it. And then there was the door to his office. And then there was this little room off the side of his office. And he was in there, and the person would always come with somebody. So when this woman who is banging her head came, she would come with another woman. And so she had a person with her. And afterwards she was looked drenched. You know, it looked like she had run a marathon. Just exhausted. So I think for Father Gary's, being in this environment activated certain aspects of his psyche in a way that he probably had never had happen to him before. He attributed some of that to these attacks, to demonic attacks, to the fact that he was being tempted to do certain things, you know, not to do certain bad things, but just, you know, negative things, or not being such a holy person, as far as, you know, drinking too much, or whether it was temptations as far as, you know, sexual temptations or temptations of power. You know, that's the other thing. These exorcists are these people really, you know, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. What would I do without you? Kissing their hands, and you're sort of like a holy man, and you feel the sensation of self-importance, and all those are triggers to what these exorcists describe as, you know, these doorways in which they can be influenced by these negative beings. And so he wasn't physically attacked. He didn't get thrown across the room or anything like that. I know other exorcists have said that they've been physically attacked, but the dichotomy is that the way the Catholic Church looks at it is that God is in control, because the devil is a creative being. So if you're being attacked, then God is allowing you to be attacked. It's a little odd to think of it in that sense. But it really, I think, negates the idea of some of the more Hollywood tropes that you see out there, like the homicidal maniac murdering people as they're possessed by a demon. According to the exorcists I talked to, that's not how it works. You know, the person is not completely taken over by the evil spirit. They're still in control. It's very interesting. I don't know if you want to get into that, but it's this idea of influence and how these evil spirits are said to be able to influence people and things like that. So
yeah, no, actually, that was exactly the next question I was going to ask you. So yeah, feel free to get into it, please.
I mean, I think maybe he had a chair thrown at him or hit the wall. And I think a woman was swinging a chair. That's the kind of stuff we're dealing with here. He didn't. And then, but then the stories that you read about, you know, exorcists are driving their car. The car doesn't start. The lights turn off while they're navigating a difficult, windy road. I had one exorcist I talked to. He's since has passed away. His name was Father Gramolazzo. And he was, at the time, was the president of the International Association of Exorcists. They actually have, they have an association, and there's hundreds of exorcists from all over the world. He was the president. I talked to him, very quiet man. He kind of had like a little bit of a speech impediment, very soft-spoken. And he was describing an incident where a priest was hurt in an exorcism. I think he performed an exorcism. He walked out of a church and a stone fell on him. And I don't want to say it cracked his, you know, broke his back, but it was something along similar to that. And I asked him, I'm like, well, but he's a priest and isn't God, you know, why would God allow that to happen? And he just kind of like shrugged his shoulders. I don't know. You know, and he kind of smiled as wow. if to say, I just do what I do. You know, I'm a man. I don't speak for God. So there's this kind of, I don't say willingness on the part of some exorcists, but this understanding that they're dealing with forces here that, you know, they're trying as best they can to manage and control, but it isn't them as a person doing it. It's the, you know, the power that's coming from God and their understanding of God. So it's a very interesting place to think about from a human side, right? You know, this is a person, a man. In other religions, there are women who can perform exorcisms. In the Catholic Church, is just a priest. So that was interesting to me, you know, just from that, again, back to that human side.
How far have you dug into exorcism in other religions, in other practices?
You know, I pretty deep. I didn't go into, let's say, almost every tradition, you know, Hindu, Taoism, Muslim, Judaism, of course, evangelical Christianity, they have a different approach. Everyone has a version of exorcism. I think, Morgan, you were talking about this earlier too, in the Bible, you know, one of the interesting things for me was that Jesus, of course, in the Catholic Church, in the Christian tradition, exorcism comes from Jesus. Jesus casted out, you know, evil spirits in the Bible, and he taught his followers to do these kinds of things. But he wasn't the only exorcist of his time. There were other exorcists going around. I didn't know that. I was fascinated about that. There were Jewish exorcists who used a ring to pull out an evil spirit. And in fact, the Pharisees even accused Jesus of performing an exorcism by invoking the name of an evil spirit. And, you know, Jesus famously said, you can't cast out an evil spirit by invoking an evil spirit. It doesn't work that way. Because he was so simple about how he went about doing it. Jesus just used his name, or he just commanded the evil spirit to be cast out. What I found really fascinating, not only is that Jesus wasn't the only exorcist during that period in history, which makes a lot of sense, is that if you look at anthropologists and what they're studying in native traditions in South America and in Africa, there's a whole host of literature that's really, really interesting about demonic possession, spirit possession, I guess you could say, and about how certain cultures use it in different ways. And in some cases, it's almost like folk therapy. They don't have access to psychotherapy or, you know, a psychiatrist or psychologist, so they use evil spirits. There's a tribe in Africa where the women use demonic possession to be empowered, and they ask for gifts. They force their husbands to treat them nice, in other words.
yep.
but there, you can see that there's a human aspect there, and I saw it a little bit, and this is where we have to be cautious, because I did see cases where, you know, it was like, okay, it could be here that there's the woman who's trying to impress her husband, who's very devout, that she's also devout. Mm-hmm. And so it crosses cultures. And so I read a lot about that. And I found that aspect of exorcism to be really interesting, you know, the native cultures and how it doesn't just happen in the Vatican, it happens all over the world.
Well, that's kind of what ayahuasca treatment is about anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. And just to touch on that idea of the women and the gifts and things like that, it's actually, for the audience, it's called or was known as the Tsar possession strategy. And they were they learned that it cost the husbands money to go and have them exercised if they weren't doing what their husbands told them to do. So there was a whole line of or a whole time period where they would set their husbands up and allow them to basically pay for this, which of course cost the husband money, and it taught the husbands after a while to stop doing that because they were apparently losing quite a bit of money.
Yeah, no, and you can see it. I mean, if you're in a society where one half of the population is repressed and they have no avenue for expressing their emotions in any way, but it's a religious society and they think in terms of animism and spirits everywhere, well, you know, they may turn to that kind of thinking in order to feel better. But then on the flip side, there is actually, and this was interesting too, through the, you know, scientific community, there actually can be some benefits to some of these ritualistic ceremonies that help them heal. You know, there's a difference between healing and curing. And healing, you know, is the mental well-being of an individual. Curing is more a biological disease that needs to be cured. And they found that in some of these native societies, you know, they can actually be helped. And some of that works even in modern day thinking when you think of stuff like obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, and they're looking at therapies that are saying, you know, you're not the cause of the problem. The cause of your problem is the compulsion, is the disease. And so you're going to put that problem onto something else, like a spirit, and then cast it out. And if you have feelings of guilt or shame and you're in one of these more primitive societies, for lack of a better word, that is a way where you can feel healed. You can cast out that thing and it actually will make you feel better. So there is a holistic healing approach side to it as well.
Well, and it makes sense because, I mean, you even think of something as simple as you know, journaling, which I think the majority of people, definitely the majority of our listeners probably do. And just the idea of being able to expel what it is onto a piece of paper. And then you hear about people having different rituals with that, whether it be, you know, putting them in the sink and lighting it on fire, or, you know, just ridding themselves of that. And I know in New York, they had a great thing. It's around New Year's where you can go and cast out the negativity of that year. And it usually takes place in Times Square, and you can go and basically put it out there. Everybody lines up and you put it out there as to what you want to leave behind. And sometimes like they'll have a punching bag, sometimes they'll have whatever it is. But the idea is that you go up there and then you let it go. And I think they've got a fire bowl or something like that as well, where you write it out and you get rid of it, and you kind of announce the fact that you're getting rid of it, and you denounce whatever that negative energy is for you and get out of it. And I think, Matt, like you're totally right, where there's this aspect to this, I think, that we don't think of as exorcism, but yet it is still the idea of being able to project it onto something else and just getting it out of your own system, getting it out of your own consciousness and to get rid of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to the Catholic approach to exorcism, and what's interesting about that and connected to what you were just saying is it really is dependent on the individual. So now we're back in the world of the Catholic Church. We have the Catholic priest who's been nominated by his bishop, so he has that chain of command to say you are approved to perform an exorcism. He has the ritual in his hand, the ritual which was written down in 1614 and really not changed much since then. And he has he's been to confession, and he's got his prayer group with him, and he's in this massive church. and this person's been vetted and the doctors can't fix them and they're still having these weird issues in their house, you know, poltergeist-like activity, and they've been having issues and they're with depression and they just don't know what's going on and nothing's working in their life. And so they're here, that they are in front of the exorcist, and the exorcist begins to pray the ritual. Well, it's still up to that person to ultimately heal themselves. And I think that's the interesting thing about about the approach that the Catholic Church had that I didn't know. You know, it's not a magic ceremony. The priest isn't there as a magician to cast out this evil spirit. And like, now you better get your act together. I don't want to see you again. Like, I did all the work for you, right? Yeah. It doesn't work that way. The person has to be the one. And so this gets into a whole interesting aspect of how do people become possessed? How do they open themselves up? And then how does an exorcism, you know, what is actually going on when the priest is praying the ritual? And there are some aspects too to the nature of the priest. Is he believing in what he's doing? Does he feel this positive sensation, this energy, this connection? Is he a holy man, and not in the sense of, you know, like a comic book, but is he trying to live his life in accordance with his faith? One of the interesting things is that you don't have to convert to be a Christian in order to be liberated. These Catholic exorcists are praying over people in Rome who are of all denominations. And I had one Catholic exorcist, is actually Father Amorth. He since passed away. I was able to interview him, and he told me, I just tell them, practice your faith. Be a good Muslim, be a good Hindu, be a good whatever it is. And it's this idea of, I think, turning toward the light, right? If your faith is telling you to do bad things, that's not really a good religion, and that's a whole different experience. I'm talking more about the faiths that are trying to open you up to goodness and be a kind, empathetic person, love, forgiveness, those kind of things. And so there's a lot going on, but at the heart of it, the exorcism is a prayer, and the priest, what he's doing, or what the exorcist is doing, is he's essentially weakening the power that this evil has over the person. He's not casting it out. He's weakening it to the point then that the person, by turning themselves away from the darkness to the light, casts it out. And I found that to be fascinating, because I thought, well, wait, what do you mean? I thought, you know, the exorcism starts and it could go on for 2 days. And then if the priest doesn't cast out the demon, it's a failure. He failed, and that demon won. But that's not how it is. I'm just going on off of the Catholic Church and the teachings and things like that. Not saying that that's the right way or the only way, but that's just the approach that Father Gary, I followed. So it's a process. It's a process for the Catholic Church. And when you think about how a person opens themselves up to evil, and then how the exorcism and the demonic process works, it makes sense.
It does make sense. And what I find so neat about what you just said, I'm sitting here on the other side of the mic, you're just grinning, because it resonates. That really resonates with me on so many levels. I mean, like Mike and I, we talk about on this show all the time, this, you know, the idea of setting an intention and aligning with that intention. And when I'm you know, watching sort of, or reading, I guess, these examples of exorcism, the one thing that I really see is this kind of overarching pattern, no matter, like you're saying, no matter what religion it's in or belief system that it's in, is somebody that is in their full alignment and somebody who is not in their full alignment for whatever reason. And I've always felt and believed that is somebody who is fully in their alignment has the incredibly powerful ability, no matter what it is, if the person is ready and makes that decision, that they will pull, they have a draw to pull people that are maybe, you know, not in alignment for whatever reason, whether it be, you know, depression or upset or, you know, whatever it is in their life, that they have a pull about them where you want, because I really think our inner being, our inner self, you know, it looks for joy, it looks for happiness, it looks for health. And there's a pull to people that are radiating that. And when I hear about these different cases and whatever, I can't help but see that similar pattern within this as well, where if you've got somebody who's saying, hey, you know, remember this, remember, you know, hey, look, you know, there's family or there's this or there's that. And completely, I think it's completely accurate in the sense that it really does come down to the person, like no matter what their situation is, even if it's in a situation like, you know, possession or anything like that. I know with my clients, it is in parapsychology and people that are struggling with bizarre things going on in their home. You know, it's so interesting to see how when they're and like their position in their mind, that mental position changes, the changes that begin to happen around them. And usually it takes somebody to call them forward to say, hey, you know, come this way. They don't have to do it, but you know, if they do, these grand changes start to happen. And it's so interesting again, like just to see this pattern once again in these scenarios too.
It's empathy. And I think that's what Father Gary learned. He learned that these exorcists are, especially the one he apprenticed to, are treating the people almost they're using a pastoral approach. They're asking them how they're doing. They're trying to bring them back to the light. And if you look at the ways, you know, the traditional ways that the Catholic Church says a person can open themselves up to an evil spirit, you know, they say occult, the occult, tarot cards, Ouija boards, there's exorcists who believe in things like a curse. I don't necessarily believe in curses, but there are lots of really well-known exorcists who do. And dedication to demons, life of hardened sin. But I think the important thing to think about is not the acts themselves, like a tarot card reading. It isn't that a person is going to grab a deck of tarot cards or play with a Ouija board and instantly become attacked by an evil spirit. It's not the act itself, but it's more the mental state that these acts create in the individual. And it's how that mental state can then begin to drive a wedge between that person and push them into a darker area of their life. So maybe, let's say if they get really into these kinds of things and there's people who in their family or their who don't like it, maybe they'll cut those people off. Or they'll associate negative things in their life to not, hey, it's on me. You know, I didn't prepare hard enough for that job interview. I could have done better. The next one I'll get. You know, we're not all perfect. We can't all win every single time. But it's, again, it's that mental state. It's creating a mental state in these people.
I can't agree more.
Yeah. So that's kind of where the Catholic Church goes with that. Again, I think it's very hard to say, well, I'll put it this way. Even though they have this list of the things that they say, you know, you should avoid, at the end of the day, the Catholic Church believes that it's up to God. And there are sorts of people, and even, you know, Father Gary told me this. I asked the exorcist, well, how did this person become possessed? And the exorcist said, I don't know. So I think there is this level of we can only do what we can do. And I would say I'm more okay with that when it's connected to the approach of I'm not a magician. I'm not a holy man. I'm not here to tell you are making all these mistakes. I'm more of a family friend who's trying to bring you back to love and compassion. If that's the approach, I'm okay with the exorcist maybe saying, I don't know what the cause of this person's suffering could be. You know, I know it's not mental illness because I've discerned through, you know, the mental health professionals that it isn't, but I'm going to pray with this person. I'm going to tell them they're not alone. And I think that's a pastoral approach. And so Father Gary learned that, and it really helped him kind of understand, hey, I can do this. I can do this because I'm good with people. I love being, you know, a pastor of a parish. I'm not an action hero. I'm not going to be up there waving my wand and screaming and, you know, objects are flying around the room. So I think it works with back to the earlier point I was making about, okay, well, what is a demonic possession? You know, how does that work? And this is why it's so important for the person to be actively involved in their deliverance. So according to, I found this exorcist who was very, very knowledgeable. His name was Father Nanny, Gabriel Nanny. He wrote a couple books. I think he had a PhD. He spoke many languages. He was the one who I believe the most. And maybe that's a flaw in me. You know, I found somebody who's very educated, who's very calm. And he told me, for instance, a story where early on in his career, he went in to see a woman and she was in a chair. It was like the mom was there with her daughter. I think she was in her 20s and she was dealing with issues. And he went to pray the ritual and she was in a chair and she was facing away. So the other end of the room facing away. And he was talking to the mom and the mom was saying, okay, we need help. This is all these things going on. And he thought, I'll say a little prayer in my mind to see what happens. Sometimes these exorcists do that. So he said, I'll say a little prayer, but I'll say it in French. So he started to pray in French, just a little prayer to see what if this woman, the daughter in the chair facing the opposite direction would react. He said, as soon as he started to pray it, the girl flipped around, like the chair spun around. She looked right at him. The eyes went up. So you see the whites. And she said in the gruff voice, it's useless that you pray in that language because we know them all. And I think that those are the stories for me that were kind of, wow, okay, that isn't mental illness. Whether that's a demon or not, I can't say. But so this idea, well, why did the girl turn to him? Why did the eyes go white? What was that all about? And this goes into, and this is something I go into really in great lengths in the book. You know, it's about the different types of evil spirits and how they manifest and what people assume is going to happen. And Father Gary was no different. And I think we're going through, you kind of see things through his eyes. So he went into this expecting what he would see in a Hollywood movie, didn't get it. But the way these people are reacting depends on a number of scenarios. And the interesting thing that Father Nanny told me was that, because I asked him, well, where's the demon? Where is it hiding? Like, because what's happening in the ritual is the exorcist begins to pray the ritual. Now he's gone through his discernment. He's decided that this person is possessed by an evil spirit. He's going to pray the ritual. He has permission to do it. He begins the prayer. What happens? Well, there's a whole host of different reactions. Some people are rigid. Some people show no reactions at all. Some people cough. A lot of people would burp and they would have these weird reactions. And then some people would get the real strong reactions. So I asked, you know, Nanny was telling me, well, what's happening is when these people are possessed and he's come to the conclusion that they're possessed. The demon isn't there in their body. It's not hiding inside them because it's a spirit. It's not anywhere in our physical reality, but it acts on them and it sends signals. It sends inputs. It sends messages, you know, leading them to be in despair and depression and all these issues and things. But when the exorcist begins to pray the ritual, then the demon, it's like they're sucked through the pipe and they go into the person in that moment. And then they have these reactions. So if the person has no reactions at all, it could be that and this is what the exorcists say, could be according to them that the demon is strong and is able to resist the prayer. Let's say entity rather than demon if you're more comfortable with that. But it could be that the entity is strong and resists the prayer, or And again, going back to what we were saying earlier, the exorcist has this connection through his mental state, this strong belief that what he's doing is helping this person, and he's using the name of Jesus as in this power, as this power source of power, and he's forcing this entity to material to be present in within this person. And then you get the strong reactions. And it's usually the aversion to the sacred. So that's why the eyes go up, because the evil spirit can't look at the sacred objects in the room, the crucifix, the stole, you know, the various things that are in the room, because they're always performed. And yeah. And then the exorcist is praying the ritual. It's very hard on the person. They get, you know, they feel pain, like a mental pain, let's put it that way. It's trying, it's an ordeal, especially if they're struggling. You know, sometimes they're trying to break free, they're being held by their family members, or they're, you know, they're banging their head like this one woman was. And then the demon will, or the entity will detach itself, because it becomes exhausted. It goes away. The exorcist, the person goes into a trance. The exorcist does a little thing to bring the person out of a trance. And then the person will be exhausted, but they'll be a little bit better for a longer period of time, if that makes sense. And then over time, so let's say the exorcist, a very strong case, would see a person, Father Carmine would see a person maybe once a week. Well, over time, you see them once a month. And then over time, you see them once every 3 months, and et cetera. And then it's they gradually are becoming more integrated in their community. They're returning to the more positive mental state to then when finally the demon is cast out in that you know, moment of liberation, if you will, and then it's gone. And so it's a process. It's a kind of a rambling, long-winded way of describing some of the different, trying to bring some of those disparate elements together.
It's so powerful. And yeah, and thank you for taking everybody through that, because I think I think there is that misnomer that we've seen in the media for so long as to what exactly that this looks like. And like you said, just the idea that you know, this is completely up to somebody else in order to you know, liberate these people from what, you know, whether it be an entity or whichever. And I think one of the biggest takeaways from this for me has been that yet again, you know, it comes back to an intention and a decision, which I think is so powerful. Throughout all of this, Matt, and this is kind of a big question, but now that you know you've done the book, you've delved into this on such a fantastic level, what is consciousness to you now? What does it mean to you now?
I mean, that's a great question. I think we could have another hour long podcast about consciousness, and
probably
for sure
probably talk to experts on consciousness and know a lot more than I do. I mean, it's fascinating. And going back to what I said earlier, I'm very curious. I have an open mind. And I just, for me, it's just a much more interesting world to live in, where there are things out there that we don't know and we can't explain, than to say we have all the answers. So for me, this experience opened me up to the possibility that there's an aspect, another layer or level to our existence that we may not have all the answers to. And hopefully one of the purposes of the book for me, because I did look at other approaches to exorcism and I saw how people were demonized, how they were stigmatized, how they were hurt in exorcisms. You're a sinner, you're evil, and how wrong that is. And how frustrated it made me feel that there were people out there who were looking for help and were turned away from compassion. So for me, if there was any aspect, was I can't say whether or not the spiritual world is real. There, I want to believe that there's more to life than the material world. It just feels like a better existence. But regardless of that, you know, these people need to be treated with compassion, and they don't need to be seen by other individuals, preyed upon, let's put it that way, by people who want to, you know, demonize them, say, yes, your problem is evil spirits, or you're a sinner, or you're not doing this, or you're not doing that, all this judging, as opposed to a more holistic healing approach of, you know, trying to pray with people and help them find a better path and kind of return toward the light. And I found that to be, you know, the same result of Father Gary and kind of where he ended up. And I appreciated that as well.
Well, Mike, you know, as we've talked about this so much, is so much that it comes back to the people and just how we treat each other, and especially like the way the world is now, and the, you know, not shoving people into labels because of what we believe is going on with them, or the casting that judgment on how they're processing something, whatever the reason is. I think that's the nail on the head right there. Matt, thank you so much for this. We so appreciate you and coming here and just laying this out for people so that we can get a better understanding of all of this. I know I've learned a ton, as I always do with this show, and just thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, no, it was great. I really appreciated talking to you guys.
Alrighty, and we are back after our conversation with Matt Baglia. What a great guy he is, number one. And it's interesting, he's still living in Italy. he's over there doing his thing with his wife and kids and that kind of thing. And so he's still immersed in this stuff while he's over there.
Yeah, I mean, his knowledge base is so vast, and I love his take on it. I love the depth in which he examines this stuff, and mm-hmm. It comes back again, you know, every episode. I swear we're going to sound like broken records, but it comes back every single time to belief and consciousness.
Yeah.
Every time.
What I thought was really key to our conversation with Matt were, like, I mean, he laid out some things that I wasn't exactly aware of. For example, that exorcists just don't barge in and do their thing. They actually will consult medical and mental health professionals as well along the way to see, you know, if there are other means that they can assist this person before they get into this kind of thing. Or will an exorcism actually help or hurt the situation? So it's wow. They're actually taking some responsibility instead of this, just this, I hate to use this phrase, but blind faith, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And what really got me about this entire experience and going back to Father Gary Thomas was how he was able to process what was happening around him when he was struggling with his own belief about it. Mm-hmm. And what I really found interesting about all of this, and what I find interesting as somebody who's a parapsychology researcher, is that this phenomenon, no matter what it is, has this ability to mirror back to us exactly where we are emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've seen this for years, you know, doing investigations and talking to people and eyewitnesses and all sorts of things. And it never fails to amaze me that the interactions that we have with non-physical are so reflective of our own mental and emotional positioning in the world. Mm-hmm. And this conversation to me, again, begins to mirror that back as well. And I'm seeing the same pathology, the same patterns over and over. And I think there's such a profound lesson to take away from that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are some people who would say that what you and I do, just investigating all this stuff, we are putting ourselves in a position, a dangerous position, where they believe that the occult is an entry point for the quote-unquote devil's influence, you know? Like, If we're looking at these dark things, these interesting things, these mysteries of the mind and the soul and the spirit, whatever you want to call it, whatever you want to call it, just by our looking into it, we are putting ourselves in a dangerous position. I call baloney. You know, I mean, I have a pretty healthy spiritual practice that I do every day. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm protecting myself from the evil eye and using amulets, although I'm not saying that people who do that are silly either. The things that I do, I feel put me in a place where I'm sort of healthy enough to look at this stuff without becoming somewhat psychotic.
Yeah. And that's such a great way of putting it. I think, you know, when you get into this field, it can be a bit of a slippery slope mental health wise, right? Like, and we see that sometimes in stuff people post online and things like that, where people are, you know, maybe struggling with some mental illness or something like that. And this field, it can be a unhealthy enabler for that. But yeah, I think within this spiritual practice and within this field and whatnot, there is the equal opportunity for the opposite of that, which is this can make you healthier. You know, being able to look inwards and be able to see more of yourself. And I think when you're present and you can see more of who you are and be present with yourself and walk into this field in that presence, then you have this ability to experience more of what the world has to offer. And I think that's the difference, is that level of unconsciousness versus consciousness and how we move into the field, exactly like what you were saying.
It's really important for you to take care of yourself regardless of what you're into.
Huge.
I'm watching, I watch, you know, I have my pet thing recently has been UFOs and all that kind of stuff. When I get into something, I tend to grab the reins with both hands. I'm trying to be healthily skeptical and critical of everything that I read and take in. Whereas I'm a member of a few different subreddits where people will post things and it's just like, this is real, this is real. And they're so convinced. And then someone will say, well, actually, this was an art piece that was posted in 1974 and blah, 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 blah. And even when they post that kind of thing, people are still, no, this is you're not telling us the truth. You're
yeah.
It is so bizarre. Belief is such a bizarre thing.
It is.
Yeah,
confirmation bias, right? Like, and when you disrupt that, oftentimes the natural response for a lot of people that aren't present, that, you know, like we were saying before, is to dig their heels in, and that's when you really know you've got some confirmation bias. You know, is that they can't look at something and say, is it possible that I'm wrong? And that, I think, is the key to going into a lot of this stuff, because the paranormal in general is a field of possibilities, and the possibility exists within those possibilities that you might be wrong about a perception or what you're presenting. And so as soon as that gets shut down, you know, you're in trouble.
Sometimes your identity is tied to this belief so strongly that if somebody says something otherwise, It's like a huge threat to you, to who you are. I love the human mind. I love it. I love it so much. I love to explore it and to try to understand it. But, you know, here we are trying to understand the thing that we're trying to understand with the thing that we're trying to understand. So
isn't it great?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense, but whatever. We'll continue to do it because that's the only tool we really have.
That's how you deal with the elephant in the room, one bite at a time.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That poor elephant. That's going to take a long time to eat that elephant.
That's what you got to do. Well, this was wonderful, and yeah. I'm excited to have Matt back on. I hope he comes back, and we can continue this conversation, because I think there's so much more going into this world, and being able to identify the parts of ourselves that we want versus the parts that we don't want, right. Which is another part of this that I think we can take away from it. You know, what is it that we need to exercise within ourselves and let go? Because really that's what it comes down to at the end of this is the ability to let go.
I got to let go of my desire for carbs is what I need to let go of.
That's a rough one, man.
Anyway, thank you, dear listeners, for joining us on this eerie expedition.
And remember, the line between the natural and the supernatural is often a thin one. Until next time, stay curious, friends.
Supernatural Circumstances is a co-production of Entity Seeker Paranormal Research and Teachings and Good Egg Studios. This podcast is part of the Curious Cast podcast network. Theme music by Corey Johnson of Catalyst Records in Edmonton, Alberta. You can learn more about Morgan Knudsen at entityseeker.ca and learn more about me, Mike Brown, and listen to my show, Dark Poutine, at darkpoutine.com. Feel free to email the show at supernaturalcircumstances@gmail.com.